Move the third case of the morning, Jared Adams versus Daniel Bertrand. Mr. Finley?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. There's no dispute in this case that the young woman and the young men had sexual intercourse in that young woman's dormitory room on the campus of the University of Wisconsin at Whitewater. But there was inadequate evidence presented, indeed no evidence presented, on the element of use of force, sufficient to support a conviction of second-degree sexual assault, although this court must defer to reasonable inferences drawn by the jury and to reasonable conclusions drawn by the state court. It cannot defer when those conclusions are unreasonable, and whereas here the evidence is wholly missing. According to the young woman herself, and bear in mind, she is the only witness to the incident other than the young men themselves. According to her, at every step of the way that evening, no one used any force or violence whatsoever.
I thought she was pulled at one point.
She did state at one point she stated at one point that when her roommate came into the room, one of the men pulled her towards the bed. But she was also unequivocal at that point and every other point that it didn't amount to the use of force. And in fact, after she was brought to the bed, there was touching, yes, but there's always touching in any kind of sexual encounter. But that she
Why isn't her testimony that she was pulled enough for finding a force?
Because if you think about it, any kind of intimate human contact is going to involve touching, pulling, moving one another's bodies about.
That all kind of blends into the consent issue, doesn't it?
To some extent.
You kind of argued that there's two separate things here, that consent and force, and I think they're kind of blurred in a case like this.
Well, I think they have to be different. And the reason they have to be different is because they are different under Wisconsin law. Consent is what defines third-degree sexual assault. It only becomes second-degree sexual assault when you add the element of use or threat of force or violence. It has to be something more than the kind of contact and touching that's inherent in any kind of sexual assault, because otherwise there's no distinction whatsoever between second-degree and third-degree sexual assault.
Now, Mr. Findlay, I have some sympathy for that idea, but then, since this is habeas, we have to decide who gets to define how much more is necessary to move it from third to second, or to put it differently, how much more is necessary in order to support a conviction for second-degree sexual assault, which is what we have here. And you've got the pulling onto the bed, you've got the incident later on in the encounter where he turns around, they walk back into the room, and she uses some phrase like he grabs her arm, something like that. And those may not seem as much as, you know, hurling somebody to the ground or something, but isn't it up to the Wisconsin courts to decide where that line gets drawn?
It is up to the Wisconsin courts to decide what the force element means.
Right.
But ultimately, this court has a responsibility to make sure that the court has not unreasonably applied that definition. In this case, the only definitions we have from the Wisconsin courts are that force and violence are to be given their ordinary and typical usage. And in this case, if you look at how the Court of Appeals analyzed the case, they said not one word about what force means. They cited not one piece of evidence to support their conclusion that there were force. They simply said, looking at the complainant's testimony in the light most favorable to the state, the evidence was sufficient. A bare conclusion.
Are there any Wisconsin cases that have looked at similar facts and found lack of force? I mean, I can think of plenty of Wisconsin cases that give illustrations of something that's much more obviously force, but have you seen anything that says these kinds of behaviors don't count as force?
No, we have not. And I suspect the reason for that is because it so plainly isn't force. Nobody's litigating this kind of thing. This is truly an anomalous situation, and it's sort of bizarre that this was ever charged as force, and it's sort of incomprehensible that force was ever found here. Keep in mind that pulling incident. The victim was then, after she claimed she was pulled to the bed, her roommate came to the door, she got up and left. Her testimony, nobody forced me, nobody restrained me, nobody blocked my egress. There was no force. It did not compel any sexual intercourse whatsoever. She got up and left. It was only later that she came back. If you look at her testimony, she said repeatedly, no one used force or violence. No one threatened her. No one hurt her. Indeed, she said at least 5 separate times, no one used or produced a weapon. At least 10 times, she said, no one threatened her. At least 5 more times, she said, no one raised his voice or used a loud voice. At least 7 times, she said that no one ever restrained her, blocked her exit, or kept her from leaving. If we want to assess whether this met the plain and ordinary meaning of the word force or violence, who's in the best position to know what really happened and whether this actually felt like force or violence? It's the victim. She's the only one there who saw what was happening and interpreted. And what was her interpretation of it? It wasn't force. It wasn't violence. There were no threats. That's the only evidence in this record, is her version of what happened, and she interpreted it very clearly as being not force or violence. There's nothing else in here to overcome that.
Let me ask you another question, because, of course, if the jury had been persuaded of this, when the only issue put before it is the second degree sexual assault issue, it would have had to acquit. Had counsel asked for the instruction on third degree, it seems to me quite conceivable on these facts that the jury would have convicted on third degree had it believed lack of consent but had felt uncomfortable about the force issue. If that's true, then why shouldn't we say counsel made a reasonable strategic choice to leave the jury only with this all or nothing if he thought he had a good case on lack of force?
In the abstract, that can be a reasonable strategic decision in some circumstances. I think you're absolutely right that it's more likely the jury would have convicted of third degree rather than second degree if given that choice. The problem is, on these facts, although we contend that the evidence was insufficient on lack of consent also, it was a significantly greater gamble to go to trial on that element.
Well, I just don't understand that. I mean, a lawyer is entrusted to make some strategic choices and thinks I've got a very good chance of walking here if we don't give the jury a chance to compromise, and we'll take a chance.
I think there's 2 reasons why trial counsel's rationale was not reasonable and is not owed the deference that one would ordinarily owe to that type of strategic decision. The first is, it's only a reasonable strategic decision if it's made on the basis of a full and accurate appreciation of the law and the facts. And the second is, under Wisconsin law, it's only a reasonable decision if it's made after consultation and approval by the client himself. Neither of those factors is met here. First, counsel did not make a valid strategic decision because he did not have an accurate understanding of the facts or law. What was his reason, his explanation as to why he didn't ask for the lesser included offense? It was because he said he didn't think the lesser fit the allegations. Your Honor, you've just told us that you thought third degree might have fit the allegations better. He didn't get it. He simply didn't get it. That's not a reasonable strategic decision. And the second point, of course, is that this is a decision that under Wisconsin law is reserved to the client. This lawyer never even gave the option of the lesser included offense to his client. So while it might be reasonable under some circumstances to go for broke, you can't say the client is stuck with that choice for going for broke when he didn't know there was an alternative. It just never was presented to him. So it seems to me that this cannot be a reasonable strategic decision for that reason. I take it from this light that I'm into my rebuttal. So thank you.
Okay. Ms. Tripp.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Kate Lloyd Tripp, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General in Wisconsin, and I represent the respondent in this matter. First, it's as a preliminary matter, it's critical to remember that this case is here on collateral review. This means that...
We assure you, Ms. Tripp, we are very well aware of that and could probably recite in the middle of the night the AEDPA standards for review by now. So have no fear. What I want to talk to you about, though, is even under the AEDPA standards of review, counsel's decision not to call Sean Demain, is that how you pronounce it?
That's how I pronounce it.
As a witness. This is as is not uncommon, one of these he said, she said kinds of things once you're in the room. But it seemed to me Mr. Demain's testimony was extremely pertinent as to how they got upstairs and actually what happened afterwards, the potential testimony that he saw her socializing publicly with them in the smoking area. And, you know, when you don't have much, you need to call witnesses, and this strategy of calling no one worries me.
I understand that, Your Honor, but I think that this decision is similar to counsel's decision on the decision not to request the instruction on third-degree sexual assault, and it's merely a strategic decision.
But
that
why? I mean, what possible strategic... I can certainly, as I was saying, can envision a strategic decision on the third-degree sexual assault, not going with the only witness who isn't the boyfriend or the roommate. It's a little... odd.
I think in hindsight, you know, perhaps he should have, but as far as the deferential standard goes, his
Why?
Decision was, I believe, to emphasize the deficiencies in the state's case.
But why would this have undermined that strategy?
Because I think that to present just one witness that says that he saw the victim smoking with the defendants at a different time, I don't...
And that corroborates the fact that the victim, you know, invites them up to the room, that they all leave in a happy way. It's not that these people are somehow sneaking up four flights of stairs.
Which had already been in the record by the roommate's testimony.
But the roommate's the roommate. I mean, why not reinforce that? I mean, I can certainly see why you wouldn't want, as a strategic matter, to put in something that undermines your principal defense strategy. But I see nothing in Mr. Demain's testimony that would have done that. Indeed, the only thing it would have done would have been to corroborate the defendant's account of what happened when, of course, nobody's in the room but the victim and the defendant. He's not. He can't do much about that part of the encounter.
You know, I'm not sure. I think, you know, he's testified that he made an effort to find the witness. He couldn't find the witness.
What is that effort, that locator thing?
I'm not familiar with that. I don't know. I assume he just called the campus and tried to find Mr. Demain as a student there.
But the co-defendant finds him, the one who's severed mm-hmm. from this trial. So it couldn't really have been all that hard.
Yeah, I'm not really at liberty to... I don't know how hard he tried. He obviously, my reading of the record is that he didn't believe it was that critical and that his strategy was to rest after the state's case, as he stated, to emphasize the weaknesses in that case. As Mr. Adams himself told the court after the conclusion of the evidence, he felt that he'd proved his innocence.
Well,
was she asked at cross-examination about what happened after all these, after this event?
I'm sorry,
was she cross-examined, and she was extensively cross-examined, yes. But did the cross-examination go into events that followed the encounter in the room?
I guess I'm not sure if that was on cross-examination or just on direct.
Well, what's in the record? What did she say happened after the events in the room?
She said that she called her boyfriend, Joshua Lodwick, I think his name is.
Right.
And that she went over to his dorm. She didn't want to stay.
So in other words, she gave an account different from standing around in the smoking area socializing.
Right.
So her account could have been impeached had Mr. Demain been called.
I suppose, although Joshua had testified the same as that she testified.
Well, but in other words, so his could have been impeached too. There was another
right.
story out there about
right.
what happened afterwards that
yes,
the jury never
I'm not
never
defending
heard.
His decision not to call Mr. Demain. In hindsight, it's clear that it would have been, I think, a good decision to do so. But I don't know that it was deficient. I don't believe that it was deficient performance not to do so. And I don't believe that the Court of Appeals decision finding it not deficient is an unreasonable application of Strickland.
But, of course, the only thing this case is about, really, is her credibility, right?
Correct.
The only issue.
Which is uncontroverted, right, because he
chose. So there's no... It's hard to see strategy dictating that you shouldn't attack her credibility.
Well, I think he did attack her credibility on cross-examination.
Well, okay.
As well as the cross-examination of her roommates and her boyfriends.
I mean, the force problem is a difficult one as well, because actually if you look at all of the Wisconsin case law on the difference between second and third degree sexual assault, Wisconsin has chosen to make this difference.
Right.
And so the amount of, you know, force can't be, you know, pushing somebody on the hand or even mm-hmm. the touching that's inherent in sexual contact. It has to mean something a little more common, let's say. It's really hard to see force on her account of what happened.
I agree that this is a close case, but I think that given the entire environment of 3-on-1, a young woman who's 6 days away from home in a small dorm room had been pulled to the bed by...
Who'd had 3 beers. I mean, it's a date rape. You know, it looks to me like a date rape situation, but force is the issue, not unwanted sexual contact.
Or threat of force, which I think you can find in viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, when Mr. Hill, co-defendant, blocks her in the hallway, her testimony is that she turns him around and directs him back to the dorm room. Following behind him, she enters the room, is ordered to sit down.
Does she ever explain why, when she runs out to the roommate, to the other room that the roommate went to, she didn't just leave by a different way, or why she didn't duck into the resident assistance room which she had to walk past?
She doesn't fully explain that. It seems to me from the record there were two stairwells. She was only familiar with one of them. She chose that one, and that's where
she walked past the RA's room.
Right. But it's also, you know, 2 in the morning, so I don't know. She's 6 days there. I'm not sure that it's fair to think that she'd be comfortable knocking on a...
Well, okay.
I think the threat also comes after that. At that point, I'm not sure that it's risen to the level of the threat. But after she meets Mr. Hill in the stairway and he turns her around, she's directed back to the room and she's ordered she's told what to do. Mr. Adams is pulling at her pants, which she doesn't want him to do. I think that that's an environment that it was fair, at least a fair reading from the record, to find that the threat of force was there. Okay, well, I just ask that you affirm the decision of the district court and deny Mr. Adams' habeas relief.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Finley.
Thank you. I think the court has hit on another important issue here regarding the lack of effort to obtain Sean DeMaine. I think he obviously was a very critical witness. I should point out in that regard, in terms of whether it was a strategic decision, both Mr. Fisk, counsel for Mr. Adams, and co-counsel, Mr. Luxinger, indicated that they did want Sean DeMaine, that they thought he would be helpful. They just didn't put much effort into finding him. And I think the efforts were simply to make a few phone calls. No investigator was hired, and as you suggested, Judge, it was obviously not too difficult since co-counsel for the third defendant did find him. In terms of whether he was the complainant was ever cross-examined about what she did after the attack, there was no evidence that I can recall in this record about that she did anything other than call.
But tell me, was DeMaine's involvement in this incident? Apparently, he said he met these three guys and he invited them in, and so on.
Right.
His statements about what happened after, when they were outside or something. Were those in the police reports?
Yeah, the copy of the police report we have is very, very hard to read, but yes, it was.
What did it say? I mean, did this come to light later? Or did it,
no, no,
was
this,
it something that was known at the trial?
No, my understanding is that it was known in advance, that it was in his police report, that it could have been known, which is one of the reasons why they wanted to pursue him.
And that police report's in the record?
That police report.
What Mr. DeMaine...
Yes.
Said. He was actually a student at Whitewater. These other three were not students.
That's right. Yes, and that report is in the record that you have before you. It's a handwritten police report.
Okay.
It's very difficult to read because it's handwritten and it's not a good copy, but he does in there, I believe, refer to the fact that he saw the tall one, which would be the complainant in this case, outside afterwards. Nothing was ever brought out about that at Mr. Adams' trial. So thank you very much.
Thanks. This case will be taken under advisement. I understand you were court appointed. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, we appreciate your good work for your client.
Thank you.